Welcome to the Parent Advocate Podcast, a show where we celebrate, defend, support, and uplift the voices of the LGBTQIA community. I'm your host, Stephen Chikumba. My pronouns are he, him, and his. I'm joined today by my amazing co-host, Lisette Trujillo.
Hello, everyone. Lisette here, she, her, ella. The mission of the Parent Advocate Podcast is to elevate conversations and reframe narratives around trans and non-binary youth to help change hearts and minds. Each week, we bring you our take on all things from the perspective of two parents of BIPOC transgender kids.
What do we have cooking for today's episode, Lisette?
Well, Stephen, our guest today happens to be an author, intellect, scholar, and Black feminist, as well as a very good friend of mine, Dr. Stephanie Troutman Robbins.
So we are about to get our learning on. I guess that's what you're trying to tell me.
That's exactly what I'm trying to tell you.
Welcome, everyone, once again to the Parent Advocate Podcast. Let's get going. What the guan, Lisette? How was your week?
Stephen, it was crazy. Daniel gave a presentation on trans joy on Friday night. So we had to drive to Phoenix and I got to see my sisters and the babies, and they all watched Daniel present about the importance of activism and joy. And then on Saturday, we had a big event with ACLU Arizona around the statewide non-discrim, and we had some incredible political leaders come and speak, and it was a good event. It's hot here. It's not hot. It's beautiful. It's like 72 degrees, 73 degrees. But I got a sunburn, like hardcore sunburn. So you have that. And then the next 2 weeks are just kind of crazy slammed, but life is good. Daniel's still getting bullied online, which is really frustrating to me. And he still doesn't want me to report it to the school. And he sent a message to the young person who runs this burn account or whatever. And they were like, just ignore it. You know, it's not that big of a deal. And Daniel's like, but it's transphobia. Like, you are posting things that are transphobic. And so this isn't like, I don't like something about someone's, like, you know, style or something. It's bigotry and discrimination. So I don't know. I'm kind of like on the fence about whether to report it to the school or not. Other than that, it's just going. How are you doing?
All right. First and foremost, I know I probably shouldn't, but I'm ready to fight some kids. I'm ready to do some dark web sleuthing, find some children and beat them like I was their parent. Let me just be clear about that. I don't like that at all. And while I appreciate Daniel's desire and agency and independence, I'm finna like beat a child. Okay. So let me just put that out there. How am I doing? Like, these storms have been jacking up my house. And so I have to get like gutters on my house redone. And these people are trying to charge me all kinds of money that I don't want to spend, but I know I have to, because I can't just be having rainwater and all kinds of foolishness, like messing up the foundation of my house. So got some gutter people coming. That was not fun, because of course, anytime you have contractors over, they always want to talk to you about their lives. And I don't care. Just give me a quote and be gone. But gutter guys coming. On a positive note, there are like 16 dads who have confirmed and paid deposits for the dads retreat in June 7th through the 9th this summer. So I'm very excited. Wayne sent like an update last week, and it was so good to see, because it's been a little while coming and we still got a little ways to go before it's actually here. But that was really positive. You've got programs, you've got all kinds of stuff happening. So that was really exciting. What else? Oh, last week I attended an event with Garden State Equality. It was a family cafe in Camden where essentially members of the community come together. We did a session on communication and the importance of communication in families. And I was a co-facilitator with a member of Urban Promise. And it was just a really excellent session, really good insights, shared a lot with the families. That was one of those events that just recharged the battery. So it was really good. And I could talk on and on and on. Before we lose track of time, let's get to today's topics.
Let's do it.
So the NCAA is being sued by 16 athletes challenging the participation of trans women in collegiate sports. The effort is being led by, guess who, ultra-transphobe Riley Gaines, stemming from being butthurt losing to Leah Thomas in the collegiate championships a few years ago. Now, just so we're clear and we can like put this into context, 1% of the population participating in women's sports is just a thing too far for transphobes like Riley Gaines. Gaines and the 15 other plaintiffs that are filing this lawsuit. And it's just embarrassing for them. It really is. And it's annoying that we are even here.
I also just feel heartbroken for Leah Thomas and all the other female athletes who have to suffer through this discrimination and have to hear people like Riley Gaines traveling around the country testifying about why we need to protect women's sports from the Leah Thomases of the world. Just the ways in which they talk about trans women's bodies, and it's just so demoralizing. And so my heart is with Leah Thomas. I can't imagine what it must feel like to have to live through this over and over again.
Hear, hear.
A Florida man has been charged with a hate crime in the murder of a gay man at a dog park. Daryl Declan Redford has been arrested and charged with the murder of John Walter Lay, who was shot while walking his dog in Tampa, Florida. While initially claiming that he shot Lay in self-defense, Lay's family and friends told police that Redford had been terrorizing Lay for almost 2 years and had recently threatened to kill him before the shooting.
This is another one of those incidents where people's animosity towards other people is just taken to ridiculous degrees. What gives you the right to take another person's life because you don't agree with how they're living? If this person is not causing you harm, then you should leave them alone. And the fact that you're such a coward that you're going to claim that the reason you shot this person was in self-defense when you know for a fact it was premeditated just talks about just the absolute lack of humanity and compassion that these people have. It's just disgusting. The killer of Righteous Torrance Chevy Hill was apparently his cousin who he was trying to help out. Last week, we reported that Righteous Torrance Chevy Hill was killed and there was no real indication at the time as to who his murderer was. And while there is no consolation for the untimely death of anyone, I did take some solace knowing that their death wasn't a function of their identity, at least not from the perspective of Chevy's family. The family member who killed him is still on the run, and I just hope that the family can find some healing in the midst of this tragedy.
I can't imagine how difficult this must feel like for their family to be grieving two of their young people, right? And it's just so heartbreaking. There are no words, truly. The medical examiner's office in Oklahoma issued an autopsy report detailing the cause of death of Nex Benedict as suicide. Benedict, a member of the 2S LGBTQ community, died the day after they were physically assaulted in a bathroom in Owosso High School by three female students. Community members were asking for a complete investigation of the incident because of the failure of the school to protect Nex and other LGBTQ students and their lack of response to the incident when it occurred.
I am just heartbroken that Nex was so tormented in life that the only solution that they saw was to take their own life. And I am just so furious with the school district, that high school in particular, for not heeding the signs, for not taking any action, for not even doing the most basic things to investigate and or protect Nex and other LGBTQ plus students at that school. Again, my heart goes out to the family. I hope that somewhere they can find solace. And I really do hope that this school, those administration officials are held responsible and accountable for what they failed to do.
That part, Stephen, the students who bullied them are all responsible for the fact that Nex felt like there was nothing more for them to live for. And so I too hope that they're held accountable.
Lisette, once again, we're getting too deep. We've got to get to today's guest. So let's do it.
Let's do it.
Dr. Stephanie Troutman Robbins is a Black feminist scholar, mother, and first-generation college student. She is the Department Head of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Arizona and Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies. Stephanie received a dual PhD in Curriculum and Instruction and Women's Studies from Pennsylvania State University. She is the recipient of the Likens Award, the Student Affairs Faculty Impact Award, the Dr. Maria Teresa Velez Outstanding Mentor Award, and the Graduate Teaching and Mentoring Award. Stephanie currently serves as the Vice President of the National Women's Studies Association. Everyone, please welcome Dr. Stephanie Troutman Robbins to our show.
Hi, Stephanie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It's nice to see you, Lisa. Great to meet you, Stephen.
Same here. So we're going to jump right in. Stephanie, you are the head of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Arizona at a time when reproductive rights and gender diverse or gender expansive people are under attack in this country. What does this moment feel like to you?
It's a very Handmaid's Tale moment. It's a very retrograde moment. I think it's really interesting to see how, you know, we're looking at, on the one hand, all these technological advances around AI and everybody really wants to move that forward and space travel, right? And yet here on Earth and in real life, we want to go backwards. So it's really interesting, you know, we want to go forward in technology, but when it comes to human rights and actual people, we want to go backward at the same time. So I've been trying to reconcile those two things, really think about and understand, you know, this interesting kind of, you know, this dichotomy. So yeah, it's a scary time. Think about political rights. When we think about human rights, we think about policies that are intended to, again, not only thwart progress, but literally, and not, you know, not exaggerating, like literally take us backward in time. I mean, it's now, I've seen several people who are running for office publicly state that they don't think women should be allowed to vote.
And when you think of it from the perspective of an academic who's charged with enhancing the minds and critical thinking ability of your student, of supporting the professors and other academics in your departments, where does that climate impact what's happening at the university, or does it at all?
Yeah, I would say the climate definitely is impacting, and it's not just my university, right? It's higher ed and academia is really under attack from conservative groups. There's been backlash to critical race theory, to, you know, feminist theory, any kind of critical theory, anything with critical. And so we need to trace back. First, it was social justice language that was the problem. Then it morphed into DEI. We thought people could get on board with it. Diversity, equity, inclusion. Now DEI is bad as well. All this backlash against DEI. And so, you know, we're seeing these shifts. And, you know, it's really interesting. And then it connects to the anti-affirmative action and all the attacks on trans people, like all these things, critical race theory, they're interrelated. I think a lot of people view these as separate struggles. And I think that's one of my responsibilities as a scholar and an educator, is to help people connect those dots, because training in education and training in gender and women's studies very much looks at and assesses the relationships that racism, sexism, anti-trans sentiment, all of those things, how they're interrelated and what that means for people's lived experiences and people's access to everything from human rights, basic human rights, to education, to job opportunities, to the ability to marry who they want, right? Like all of those things are interconnected, and it's really important to have a critical lens. And we're seeing like just the undoing of all of these years of both activism and educational advancements, all of that because it disrupts a particular conservative agenda.
So I had another question for you, but you just said something that like piqued my interest, right? I went to the U of A and my freshman year was 1998. And then we got the internet like a year later, right? And it was like, we've all seen technology go from like these clunky computers in front of us to like our phones. And then we're also seeing like this dismantling of progress that hasn't been afforded us for very long. We're talking about like 50 plus years, right? And I'm curious to know, like, as we're seeing like Christian dominionists come in and say like their viewpoint is absent of science, right? So you have like an anti-science movement, you have a religious right movement that's merging with that anti-science. And you're also seeing like that anti-science bring in what you would think were like fringe liberalists into their anti-science kind of language. And then you're seeing like this uptick in advancement in technology. How is it that the ground was fertile for all of this to happen? And for people, how do they disconnect from like scientific advancement to continue thinking about their world in such a like very small way? Am I making sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think what I'm hearing you ask is like, how come the same people who will say that global warming or like climate change, things like that are not real, are the same people or seem to be invested in still like the sort of computer engineering, that kind of side of things, right? Which is also scientific. But so what I'll say is the common link here is around capitalism. So it's the science that is not fertile for capitalism that we don't want. The science that is capitalist in nature, right? That's going to bring AI or space travel or things that people can profit from. Wealthy people, billionaires, certain folks with access to particular, right, like resources, that's going to benefit them. So that science is good and okay. Any science science that seems like, oh, we have to consume less. Oh, we need to not just, you know, exploit all the resources and minerals and whatever. Like, oh no, we need to add infrastructure that's going to cost money so that it can be more efficient. Those are the science that's not allowed. So it's really important to see that there's also a capitalist imperative that informs some of these ideologies and the ways that people operate as well. So I think, you know, we see IVF, right, is now this has become this hot button issue. And, you know, I think one of the conversations about IVF, again, this is a reproductive technology. And while it's helped many families, but it's helped many families, the thing that people don't want to say, it's helped families that are not conservative, heteronormative, standard families, right? So a traditional hetero white families. I believe there once was a time when IVF was not accessible to non-hetero normative white Christian families. And as it became more normalized and as people started to have access through their work employer benefits or just other groups of people experienced some economic, you know, mobility and were able to access it, those other people who are accessing it, families of color, queer families, et cetera, right, who had been discriminated against in terms of adoption, shut out of that, you know, they start using IVF and having their own families. And I think that conservatives said, no, 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 IVF was never supposed to be for you all. That was just for us. So now IVF is a problem.
I'm always telling Steven how all of my friends are super accomplished. Like, I'm like, I don't know how I like made all these incredible friends, but really? You are one of them. And I'm just looking at your bio and thinking, women do not get enough credit for the lives and families we juggle, right? How do you stay inspired? Because the overwhelm of watching rights being, you know, just stripped away that were just barely gained is so real in this moment.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think if I'm being honest, I think from a young age, you know, I was actually raised very much in a traditional church-based Christian, Judeo-Christian, you know, like setting and tradition. And I will say that while I have, you know, definitely explored other religions and thought through my feelings and my relationship to Christianity, and I don't identify that way, but I do think that that young Stephanie, little Stephanie, was very interested in hope, interested in the possibility of hope, interested in the potential of forgiveness. And so I will say that, you know, I think most opportunities, even terrible ones, you know, you can come away with something from that. And so I think back on like my early child rearing, being brought up in that way. And I do think that for, at least from my church experience, while there was also some really awful things, there was also, you know, this idea around hope and forgiveness. And I do think that any sort of radical possibilities for community and society have to be rooted like in hope and forgiveness and love. And I'm really committed to those things in a non-religious, you know, context, but they kind of started in that place, right? And then evolved for me over time. And so I would just say that that's kind of who I am. And I'm also like very optimistic and pragmatic. And, you know, those are traits or qualities that kind of help me rise above. But I do have like hopeless moments. And I think about that adage, you know, that I'm not sure who it's attributed to, but it's this idea of, you know, learn to rest and not to quit. And so that's always where, you know, if I'm in despair or I'm spiraling or things are bad, I'm like, okay, well, it's time to rest, but not to quit. You know, like I'm committed to making, you know, a better life for people in my community, people in my family, my students, my own kids, right? Like it's important. And I think education, you know, is the way. Education can be really transformative, which is why it's under attack. The transformative power of education is seen in our social movements. It's seen in other places where we have made progress. So that is the place where the focus is here, right? Like, let's make teachers public enemy number one. Let's underpay them. Let's push people out. Let's make more, you know, heavily disciplined children of color. Let's do all these things to make school and education a horrible place that's defunded and disrespected so that these ideas can't be shared. So people can't learn the truth about our history or about about, you know, possibilities for a different kind of future, right? Like, let's take social emotional learning. There was a curriculum moving forward in that direction. People were on board with that. We got to teach kids empathy. We have to do better. No more. Now social emotional is also on the chopping block. Why would we want empathetic, connected human beings when we can just have AI? It's an interesting moment, but I believe in education, and I believe that we have to keep fighting.
I'm sorry. You made such a valid point that I just have to ask this next question, because in 2018, I think, you co-authored a book, Narratives of Family Assets, Community Gifts, and Cultural Endowments, Reimagining the Invisible Knapsack. And in 1989, I think, a feminist scholar by the name of Peggy McIntosh wrote an essay entitled White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack, which talked about white privilege and what white people experience every day. And as you were talking about the ways in which they're trying to pull back the things that we've gained or pull back the things that we now have access to, I couldn't help but think, like, when you wrote that book, was this like a homage to Peggy McIntosh's book, or was this you just looking at the landscape and saying, hey, we now have opportunities that heretofore we didn't have, and this is how we can take advantage of them in this, you know, this quest for higher education?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So Peggy McIntosh, I will say, I've had the privilege of meeting Dr. Peggy a couple of times. And the first time was when I was at Berea College, and we were doing a lot of anti-racist work. And we were bringing white folks like Peggy McIntosh and Tim Wise and others to the campus. And, you know, I'll never forget it, because, you know, Peggy McIntosh, she's an elder. And, you know, she comes in there looking like you're expecting her to bring like a tray of cookies. But no, she was like, everyone here is a racist. It was a really just profound experience. And this would have been in like 2011 or 12. And so that was my first time meeting Peggy, and I was familiar with her work. So I felt it really an honor to share space with her. You know, I also remember that we had a little academy in Lexington, Kentucky, it's an Afrocentric academy. And they had brought students from that academy to meet Peggy and interact with her. And she did interact with them. And then when she was about to really get into her talk on racism, I mean, she asked for them to leave because she didn't want their spirits to be damaged. And it was just such a beautiful but sad gesture of, like, because she was like, listen, I'm here to talk to you, the faculty and the community, about this. And I also want to make sure that we can talk openly, because there's a responsibility, but the responsibility doesn't belong to these children. It's on us, the adults and the educators in the community and older college students who are going to be making a way in the world. We have to do the work for them on their behalf. And so she asked them to leave so she could really be very direct in her messaging. And so that was very inspiring. And then, you know, the book, I think my co-authors and I really did draw on our engagement with Peggy's work and with her idea, using her idea of the knapsack for white privilege. And then what if we reimagine that? And instead of a deficit model of what Black students have or don't have or have to go through when they come into spaces of education and move toward higher ed or professional ed, what are the things that we have? Because this is idea that, like, we come with nothing, or that we come in from starting from behind. And while that's true sometimes because of socioeconomic status or lack of opportunity, racism, et cetera, we also have things that are assets or that are part of our culture and our communities that we value and that have helped us along the way. And I can't tell you how many times I have been asked to, you know, think about a budget or find creative ways to reason around constraints within these academic spaces that have so much money. But again, how is it allocated? Who has access to those resources? So it's actually been many times that I've felt actually, I would say, even triggered in thinking about, like, growing up as a free lunch kid with a single mom and things like that, and trying to, like, sort of, you know, one of the reasons that I took this path was to not have to, you know, struggle in a certain way. But at the same time, like, I'm still using a lot of those those resources and things that are from my family and my background to make a way in this other space. And I think the book really wanted to look at, you know, even poor folks may have amazing families. You know, lots of people who are rich in family or rich in community who have people cheering them on. I really think about that film, Akila and the Bee, and how she like goes on, you know, to this amazing opportunity and everyone back in her hometown. There's like the little montage of everybody being happy for her and rooting for her. And I think we really wanted to say, like, you know what, grit, resilience, these are interesting concepts to think about how we survive, how we thrive, how we, struggle and navigate. But there's also a real wealth of culture and community things and funds of knowledge, right, that exist within us that we bring to the space. So what about talking about that?
It's so interesting that you bring this up because I'm not in academia. So a lot of times I'm doing things that are based on instinct. And what you just talked about, Daniel and I had a conversation about this after the Tucson Festival books. Daniel was like, we were talking about just some different things. And I told him, I think the reason why I've been so committed to creating resources for families of trans youth, if I could pin it down to one moment, it was this day that I had with my grandmother where my aunt dropped us off at the hospital. And I was tasked to interpret for her that day. And I remember I failed in interpreting because I was six and I couldn't interpret medical language. And the doctor spoke a little bit of Spanish. And then when we needed to take the bus back home, I failed in interpreting where we needed to get. So he just dropped us off in downtown Tucson. And I remember my grandma being like, we're a little bit farther than I needed us to be, but I'm going to take us to Woolworths. We're going to get some ice cream. We're going to walk home. And it was like, we were gone for like an additional 3 hours, like just walking, right? Walking back to my grandmother's house. And when we got close to her house, my mom was running down the street towards us like in tears and was like, you've been gone for hours. And I just remember that it was my most favorite day with my grandma because I had all this quality time. And we had ice cream at Woolworth at the counter. And we walked and talked. And also recognizing that I was inadequate in some way in my language in carrying like and being able to translate for her and to get us where we needed to be. And I was telling Daniel, often the burden of youth in low income or immigrant and or first generation spaces, we're burdened with advocating for ourselves and also burdened with taking adult responsibilities on our own so that we can advance and get ahead. And I think that there's a better way for us to parent trans kids. There's a better way that we can build models of support for families. So my question to you, because you've triggered this, what do you think are like three things that communities of color can bring in as superpowers when it comes to giving our children the resources and the tools that they need? How can we reframe ways in which parents can step in to support their kids, even if they're working within constraints?
Yeah, so I think three things. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do, but I think you're right. I mean, we have to do more. We have to do extra. And I think one really important step is to encourage. And I do think that like encouragement is underrated. Like we say, oh, be encouraging or whatever. But it's like, no, I mean real encouragement. Like really think about how can I encourage this person, help to empower this person, whether it's my kid or a family member or community member, right? Empower them, right? To advocate, encourage them to advocate, to speak up. I think a lot of times people are afraid that they're going to say the wrong thing or they don't have the language or they're not going to be understood or whatever the case may be. So I think like encouraging folks to speak up and self-advocate is definitely needed in this moment. It's not anything groundbreaking, but you would be surprised how many people still are not speaking up in certain contexts. And unfortunately, the people who are speaking are usually people who have power, who have privilege, who feel comfortable in any and every space, and they will take up all the space. They will take up the airtime, and then others will, who look like them typically, will also start taking up space or joining on and piling on. And then things just go in a certain direction. So I think, really thinking about how can we encourage folks to speak up, speak out, self-advocate. I think another thing thing that's really important is like the resources that we to utilize resources that we have in terms of back in the day, if you wanted to get educated on it, you had to find a book or you had to take yourself minimally to the library. And depending on where or how, right, you may get to the library and it's not even there. And I remember being a little kid walking around to the, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, walking to the local library, using the resources that were there. But also I was like the child of the interlibrary loan. My library did not have any of the things that I ever wanted. And so they'd be like, okay, it's like that little black girl again, another interlibrary loan. So I just think, but now, now we are inundated with access to information and we need to be using that. These are tools. And it's really fascinating because it's a both and. On the one hand, I'm like, it's so great that people have access. And on the other hand, I'm like, it's so much more bad information or inaccurate, information to have to sift through and figure out, right, and ignore or manage to be able to tell, is this a real source? Looking through, thinking about that there's an algorithm, right, that puts certain things in front of you when you're searching. So it's not just because this popped up and all these people looked at it, doesn't mean that that's the right information about this thing. That means somebody paid, right, to have this thing pop up first in the search engine. So people don't always have some of that media literacy, which I think is extremely important, which goes back to, again, critical studies, critical media literacy, very important. But at the same time, I'm like, my hope is just that, okay, there are people who kind of grasp some of these concepts. People are having discussions about things that they would never have heard about outside of a gender and women's studies class 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. Like right now, I remember seeing the cover of, and it's, of course, some of the reporting has been problematic, but I remember how surprised I was when I saw the trans youth kind of movement picture, the cover of Time magazine several years back. I was like, wow, this is actually very important. Even if they don't get everything right, this cover about trans youth, that they exist, that they're visible, that there's a public discourse, this is important. And this is something that would never have even been able to happen, 10, 5, maybe even years prior to when it did. And part of that is because of the way information is available. You have to use the information that we have for better or worse, right? I prefer people have media literacy and use that, but to decide, right, what they should and shouldn't consume or how to engage it. But I've also exposure, because as long as you're exposed, even if you're wrong, you will say to someone else, well, I saw such and such and such. And hopefully at some point, someone will say, well, that's actually not right. Have you looked at this? And it at least there's a conversation, because without a conversation, we're not going anywhere, right? So I do think that even with certain things where I'm like, I have to correct this assumption, or no, I wish people would stop looking at this particular website, it's still we have the access. So let's use it. That would be my second thing, is use the things that you have. I don't know if I have a third thing that comes to mind right away. I think these two areas are, to me,
so important. It's interesting that you mentioned Time too, because when our kids were organizing Trans Prom, when we learned that Time was going to be the news vehicle to launch it, right? And that they were going to drop it as it was happening, I was like, this really legitimizes this political action, because Time magazine has been respected for so long.
Yes.
It's really
important. And I do think that, again, we're we know it's working because of the backlash. I think with anything, all the backlash is an indicator that when we organize in a certain way, when we get the visibility, when we have access, when we come together, we are making change. We have been making some progress. It's not enough, not nearly enough, and it takes a long time, but we were making strides. And whenever we're doing that is when the backlash becomes really strong. So I think that if anything, while it is easy to be disheartened, it's also a reminder. The backlash reminds us that, hey, actually this worked. This other stuff worked. That's why they want to undo it. So let's keep doing that other stuff, right? Even if it's been made harder, doesn't mean that you know, we know it works. So I don't care if something's hard. If I know it works, I'll keep doing it.
Beyond reimagining The Invisible Knapsack, you're also the co-editor of Race in American Television, Voices and Visions That Shaped a Nation, which is a two-volume encyclopedia which explores representations of people of color in American television. And I raise that because what we are talking about with trans prom and trans people being on the cover of Time magazine and people showing up in places and spaces where they're traditionally not seen is the value of these possibility models. You cannot aspire to that which you don't see. And sometimes just having that first person and be in that space is important. When you wrote this book, did you have something like that in mind about making sure that, you know, people in the collective consciousness were aware of the presence and value and contributions of Black people in American television?
Yeah. So I definitely think, you know, the Race in American Television book, it's there's sort of this cultural explosion around representation when platforms start to emerge, right? So we're back at technology now. Because you remember, both of you, I'm not going to out anybody's age, but we all on the screen remember when cable television was the only thing, 46 channels. So just imagine what that means for what's possible, who has access to that. I mean, I was even reading something earlier today about even the Black shows that came out in the 70s and 80s were written by white people, right? These writers' rooms are notoriously endlessly white. So it's just important to think about those dynamics. And so streaming kind of gave us like, whoa, and also just the expansion of pay-per-view television, HBO, Cinemax, all the things. So you have the TV expanding all over the place. You have the 24-hour news cycle, which then led to other 24-hour programming, right? Idea. So then you need more content. So all of these different sort of technological innovations are always, right, happening alongside these other sort of social and political things as well. And so it was important to think about how, at least for us, like before this moment of Fresh Off the Boat and Blackish and all those things, Awkward Black Girl, the things that were happening in that space, like what happened before that? Like what's the history? And I'm always interested. It's funny, I'm not a historian, but I do think that a lot of the intersectional scholarship that I do, there's a need, a necessity to like sort of harken back to like what came before, or what are the things that happened that enabled this in this moment in time? So there's always a historical arc that's important. And I think about, you know, the African activist Stephen Biko, right? He said like a people without a history is like a car without an engine. Like what are you going to do if you don't really know what happened before, what came to, you know, how things came to be in the present really has a lot to do with the things that predated that. So for me, it was like understanding, I was interested in the project of understanding how Good Times, the Jeffersons, Tonto, all these, some racist, some awful, some funny, some more accurate, right? Like how did all these different depictions eventually bring us to where we have, you know, this moment where we can have Pose and we can have, you know, Euphoria and whatever else, really thinking about that. And so, yeah, I'm waiting. We try to be very intersectional in the book. So we try to also think about gender, sexuality, queer relationships, disability, right? All those things. But I do think, you know, I'm waiting for people to do more work on these areas. And so hopefully the book is sort of here's a encyclopedic overview. And now other scholars can kind of jump in here and take up. There's a really great book that is about sort of transness and queerness and representation. I can't remember the author's name right now, but a newer book that looks at those representations specific. My hope is that we'll see more work that takes this up.
My next question is sort of cheesy, but I want to know, what are three books you recommend to beginner feminists and why?
Ooh, I don't think that's cheesy. Is that a cheesy question? No, that's important. I actually think it's tough because I wouldn't recommend the same books to sort of like my mom or like, you know, like someone who's outside the academy as I would to somebody who's, you know, on a scholarly path and sort of that trajectory. But I guess, I mean, definitely Bell Hooks' Feminism is for Everyone. I think that's like a very important, and I do think it's pretty comprehensive. Is it written for like, so that a sixth grader could understand, reading level can understand? No, but it's fairly comprehensive as sort of a, what is patriarchy? Like, what is gender? What are some important things for me to think about and know if I want to enter this conversation about feminism? And I've had some type of, you know, exposure and I have rest. So I would say Feminism is for Everybody, I think is a really important book. Some of Us Are Brave, I think it's a, which is a collection been looking at Black feminists, and it comes from that, the idea of like, well, all the men are white, all the women are white, but some of us are brave. Really like thinking about the place of sort of Black feminist scholarship and Black scholarship in the context of gender and women's studies and feminism. And there's the gender workbook, right? There's a book, it's just called like My Gender Workbook. And I think like that is also an interactive way to think about these ideas and concepts and to like kind of engage at a very introductory level with ideas about gender and sexuality that I think is a good place to begin for people who just want to try to better understand the difference even, right? Like some people I think are still in a place of not really understanding the difference between gender and sexuality. And so to me, thinking about women's experience, race, the relationship with capitalism, patriarchy, gender, I think it's important that we hold them all. So many people say things like, oh, you know, we see QT POC. I'm like, okay, queer, trans, people of color. There's so many identities inside QT POC, right? It's not one thing. It's great if it can function as a community. And I think that is the, right? That's the aspiration is for that to be the case. But there are so many individual identities and different possibilities and different intersections of identity that is encompassed in there. And so I think that so many people feel in some spaces they have to choose their sexuality and their gender. In another space, they have to choose race. They can never find a place to be whole. And for me, I want us to find places where we can be whole. But in order for that to happen, I think we first do need to understand that to the extent that we can, individual differences and experiences and the nuances that occur across these different multiple identities. So
I'm loving where this conversation is going. And it really does lead me to this thought that you're not just an academic. Your bio describes you as a scholar activist who has been recognized across a variety of community and academic spaces for mentorship, student advocacy, and social justice leadership. So against this backdrop of literally hundreds of bills drastically restricting the rights and liberties of transgender people and women in this country, what does your activism look like today?
So, yes, it's a lot of resting and not quitting. But I will say that, you know, one of the things I feel is really important is that we, for me to do, is to address this manufactured sort of infighting amongst women, right? Because right now, you know, we have the turfism and we have all these things that are happening that are dividing women against each other. And I think that they want, you know, biological women to fight with trans women. They want white women, housewives to look, you know, those, the trad wife trend, right? They want other white women to associate themselves with that identity, with that Katie Britt and Erin Hawley identity. Meanwhile, those women are rich. They have access to political power, and they are not stay-at-home moms. They are senators and lawyers. They're not stay-at-home moms. They're not like you, white stay-at-home mom. I need folks to really understand like these dynamics and how they are creating all this infighting that is keeping us from focusing on how to fight back against the undoing, you know, of our rights and of some of the progress that we've been able to make. So I think for me, my sort of scholar activism in this moment is really saying to like different women, like, no, you see that why this is a tactic, right? Or you understand how this shouldn't be the thing that we are fighting about. You see how all of us stand to lose if this is where we put our energy and our focus. So it's important to me to be able to have those conversations in a comprehensive way, to be able to bring in research, right? And to be able to help people navigate media literacy so that they can connect some of these dots, because some of it has a lot to do with that part of it, right? Which kind of comes out of my background in education as a literacies educator, like thinking about how are you deploying your literacy? And then there's just the people who have all this access and all this information, and they don't want to change. They still don't want to change, right? So figuring out like, hey, like, what is the role, or how can this person, you know, play a role still? Or what can we do to, again, not necessarily trying to change people in the sense of who you are as a personality or what's your favorite ice cream or blah, blah, blah. But like, how do you think about community? How do you understand the world? How are you contributing to a future and really just like helping folks connect the many dots. But it is exhausting. I send a lot of emails. I make a lot of phone calls. I do a lot of care work for other friends who I know are physically showing up in particular kind of spaces, right? You know, I do a lot of checking in and then also just really doing what I can to make sure that the resources, the courses that, you know, courses that we offer in gender women's studies are, you know, things that have the potential to impact like young people, giving them information and ideas and theory and knowledge that they can use, you know, to build better communities or to fight back against certain things. So I do think, you know, for me, it's sort of on all fronts. It's like the way I show up as an educator, the way I show up as a leader, the way I work with my students, most of whom are people of color or folks who identify as LGBTQ, helping my own kids navigate racism and sexism and things like that. So it's a busy time, but also, you know, it's important.
Well, you went into my next question. So I'm going to ask you something different than what we planned. Where do you find joy?
I really find joy in movies. So watching movies, if you know me, like, and again, like, yeah, like film is part of my scholarship, but even just watching movies has always been a thing that I love. And I do think that, you know, film is a good, it's a powerful medium. It has, you know, the potential to move people differently, but even just like watching movies, whether I'm watching something really silly or something that's, you know, I watch pretty much everything. And so I find that like, if I'm able to disconnect and watch film, it makes me happy. I go to the movies by myself a lot, which a lot of people do not, but I've been that way since forever. I've enjoyed that sort of time and that engagement.
Steven, just a little like for you, but Stephanie's my extroverted friend that makes me go to things. And Stephanie is actually really good friends with Mia Fowler, who was the publicist, who was Lucina's publicist and was with us at South by Southwest for the dads. And so like all of our worlds are colliding, but Stephanie does pull me out and is like, let's go watch some movies, Lizette.
Okay. So let me say, when she first came on, I was like, this is Lizette person. Sister locks, piercings, big earrings, hats, rings, different colored nails. I was just like, oh, this is one of Lizette's people. This is a Lizette person. Everybody isn't a Lizette person, but I can identify the Lizette people by, you just came on and your energy was just like, here I am, glowing with the cactus and the sun behind you. I was like, you better work.
I'm a super Sagittarius, just yeah. So people know. I'm super Sag all the ways. So,
and Daniel's second favorite person, because Stephanie loves Radiohead as much as Daniel loves Radiohead.
What? Let me find out. Okay, so I have one question for you that's going to close us out, but I have to ask you, what part of New Jersey?
I'm sorry?
What part of New Jersey?
Oh, I grew up in Bergen County, Lodi, New Jersey. My mom, I have family members from Patterson who were delivered by William Carlos Williams, because a lot of people don't realize that in addition to being a poet, he was a medical doctor. And interestingly, we also have family connections to Walt Whitman. So there's like all these like white poet connections on that side of the family. But yeah, grew up in New Jersey, like very close to New York City. We took the bus all the time into New York City, tons of time in like the Bronx Zoo and Yankee games and all the things, right? Radio City Music Hall, Rockettes, yeah. The whole nine. I was born on a military base. Ironically enough, I was born at Fort Dix. Oh, my parents were in the Army.
Up in there. So how did you get from Jersey to Arizona?
Yeah, I'll give you the very quick vagabond sort of story. Yeah. So my mom's side of the family, immigrants from Italy, Europe, whatever, through New York City into New Jersey. So they lived in the New York, New Jersey area. My dad's family, Southern people, Georgia. My parents met in the Army. And so then they had me. My dad moved back to the South. My mom stayed in New Jersey. My grandparents retired and moved to Florida, because everyone from New York and New Jersey retires and either moved to Arizona or Florida. So they moved to Florida, and we then followed suit a few years later. And so I was in Florida. And then after being in Florida for many years, I applied to grad school at Penn State and I got in. So I moved to Pennsylvania. After being in Pennsylvania and choosing to be in the academy, my advisor, I remember I thought I was so cute. This is like a first gen story. I show up. My advisor's like, okay, we're going to do the job market. Got to get ready. I'm like, cool. I get everything ready. And I also prepare a list of the 10 states in which I'd be willing to live. And my advisor goes, oh, this is cute, crumbles it up, throws it away, and says, you're applying for everything in the whole country, and you're going to treat it like a military deployment, because that is what a tenure track job, if that's what you want, if that's the goal, you go where the job is. So I thought, all right, I guess. And so I applied for everything, and where I ended up was Kentucky, which was not in the 10 list of 10 places. So I go to Kentucky for my first academic job after grad school, 2 years in Berea, a beautiful time. I got to connect with bell hooks. I got to meet a lot of wonderful people, love the students, really important work there, serving rural Appalachian students, right? And it was great, 2 years there, but it wasn't a permanent gig. So the next job was a permanent gig in North Carolina. No, not the sexy part of North Carolina, Boone, North Carolina, the mountains, isolated, scary, lots of snow, very white, but I had amazing white colleagues in Boone. So I will say that at App State, my white colleagues were like allies. None of them said they were allies, because real allies don't say that. They showed up in every way all the time. It was crazy. I was like, wow, I'll never have colleagues like that again. And sadly, I was right. That has not happened since. These are the dedicated white people. And so moving on to University of Arizona, because I got recruited here and I thought, well, even though there's not a lot of Black people, there's more diversity in a general sense. There's going to be brown people. There's going to be indigenous folks. Tucson, people think of it as like, oh, it's not a big city. It's a big city compared to Boone, North Carolina. My kids were like a Target, you know? So like literally was a huge shift for us. And now Arizona's home and I love it here.
Thank you for sharing. That's an amazing story. All right. Final question. Here on our podcast, we are always trying to give our parents and our listeners tips for raising happy, healthy, well-adjusted, transgender, non-binary, gender non-conforming children. So what advice do you have for parents for ensuring that their children thrive?
So I think like it's hard sometimes to be honest about the ways that folks who are not progressive or who are extremely conservative, sometimes it's hard to talk to kids about that. And I even remember like my older son who he identifies as, you know, cis, hetero, straight. But when he was younger, he wanted to polish his nails and things like that. And I remember we were living in Kentucky and it's very rural. And I said, well, you can do whatever you want, it's your body and I'm happy to paint your nails or do whatever, but kids might say something to you. Other kids might make fun of you. They might say things like, boys don't wear nail polish, right? And so if that happens, is that going to hurt your feelings? What will you do? He was in kindergarten or first grade. So he's like, I'll just tell them that boys can wear nail polish, duh. And I'm just like, all right, then we're good. And if anybody, you know, maybe if they say those things, but if they might also just push you, or they might act like a bully, right? And then what would happen? And then he said, well, then I'll get a grown-up. And I said, okay. So I just think having some of those conversations, not in a way that's scary or that's intended to discourage self-exploration and self-discovery, but in ways that are just honest and realistic of what might happen. And it's the same conversation. I have a different version of them with that conversation now when they say, I want to go to this protest. I'm going to show up and protest, you know, for ceasefire in Gaza, or I'm going to show up and protest for Black Lives Matter. And I say, okay, what do we need to think about? Like, what are the things that might be unsafe? What are the things to do if this or that, you know, happens? So really, I think just sort of that honest and strategic conversations that are not intended to like make them back down or not explore these things, but just so that they can be safe and that they can feel, again, encouraged, but safe, and know that, you know, they have to become, right? Like we're all in a process of becoming. And so this is part of their becoming. And I think supporting that and being honest, like, yeah, there might be people there, the police might show up and their violence might ensue, and or kids might be a bully to you, or someone might make fun of you, or this could show up in social media, right? Like, and so then what? Not to say don't do it, but like, well, then what will we do if these other kind of negative things go on or happen, or if things become unsafe? So I think having that very direct conversation while being encouraging, while offering support, helping them think about strategies and resources that they need is the way.
Oh my God.
Look at you being the teacher and pulling in the entire lesson at the end. I love that.
I love it. And I just want to say kudos to you and your parenting, because these are very difficult times. They are very difficult times for people of color. They're very difficult times for women. They're very very difficult times for gender expansive people. They're very difficult times for the poor. They're very difficult times. And for us to be able to have hope, I love that that's how you lead. You lead with hope. And to be able to talk to people about the importance of thinking critically and developing the ability to think critically, it's so necessary in this time. So we thank you so much for joining us today and for all of your insights. Now it's time for our recurring segment, Allies and Assholes, where we highlight individuals or groups that are supporting the LGBTQIA community on the one hand and call out straight up assholes who are trying to move us all backwards on the other. Lisa, who are we talking about today?
Our ally of the week is Planet Fitness. Planet Fitness permanently banned a member who took a picture of a trans woman shaving in the locker room, a violation of the gym's policies. The banned woman, Patricia Silva, recounted her experience at Planet Fitness, confronted the patron about being in the women's locker room, repeatedly misgendering her in the process. In a statement, Planet Fitness said that while people might feel uncomfortable with trans folks using the same space as them, this discomfort is not a reason to deny access.
This is what it means to stand with trans people, pushing back when bad actors do things that not only violate policy, but violate the humanity of others.
And this is why Planet Fitness is our ally of the week.
Congratulations to Planet Fitness. Now on to our asshole of the week. Our asshole of the week is the U.S. House of Representatives. Last week, the House of Representatives voted to ban the app TikTok, owned by Chinese company ByteDance. The Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act passed with overwhelming support from both Democrats and Republicans. If it passes the Senate, the bill would remove TikTok from app stores in the United States unless ByteDance agrees to sell it to an American company.
Can we talk about how censoring people is just fuckery? It doesn't matter what party you belong to. So frustrating.
Lisette, the House of Representatives has never voted for anything by these margins. Anything, period. And the one thing they can get together and vote for is to ban an app that has single-handedly changed the face of social media. And that's why the House of Representatives is our asshole of the week. Well, that's our show for today, folks. I want to thank today's guest, Dr. Stephanie Trotman Robbins, for joining us today. And of course, I got to give it up to my co-host, Lisette, for rocking with me all damn day.
Steven, you know I couldn't do this without you. And of course, we couldn't do this without you, our listeners. So thanks for tuning in to the Parent Advocate Podcast.
And folks, please be sure to subscribe to our podcast and our YouTube channel. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok and do whatever you've got to do to stay up to date with everything we're doing here at the Parent Advocate Podcast. Bye!
Goodbye.
If you're thinking about harming yourself, get immediate support. Please reach out to the Trevor Project and connect to a crisis counselor 24/7, 365 days a year from anywhere in the United States. It's 100% confidential and 100% free. You can get help at thetrevorproject.org. If you'd like to support any of the organizations working actively to support LGBTQ people, please visit the ACLU at action.aclu.org or the Human Rights Campaign at hrc.org.
You've been listening to the Parent Advocate Podcast. Tune in again for another episode.